I had a client in front of me a couple of years ago. Now we became actually quite good friends, who said to me, I'm not like everybody here at Le Bernardin in our dining room. I'm just a regular guy from a suburban area. So I barely can afford a meal here. Can you recommend me a wine for regular civilians? And he was rather provocative with that. And I said, sir, I love the area where you're from because I live also in the suburbs in Brooklyn. I said, but in Brooklyn, not many people wear FP Journée. So with a little sense of humor, you can do so many things.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. There are certain things that often get paired with watches. Watches in cars, watches in cameras, and watches in wine. And this week's guest knows a lot about that third one. His name's Aldo Sohm, and he's the sommelier at three Michelin star restaurant Le Bernardin and his eponymous Aldo Sohm Wine Bar here in New York City. He's somebody who's been on my radar for a long time, but I never actually knew he was a watch guy. It was a ton of fun bringing him here into the studio to talk about our mutual love of watches, as well as his new book, Wine Simple, which is all about making wine more fun and more approachable. It's something that all of us here at Hodinkee can really appreciate. After that, we have a conversation that was recorded back in the fall between Jack and Grand Seiko designer Nobuhiro Kosugi. The two of them talk about all things Grand Seiko design, everything from the 44 GS case and why it's become so iconic, to the way that nature plays a role in the design process at Grand Seiko. It's a fascinating look at a manufacturer that's often relatively secretive. Without further ado, my chat with Aldo. This week's episode is brought to you by the Hodinkee Shop. Stay tuned later in the show to learn more about how the Hodinkee Shop is changing the watch buying game. For more, visit shop.hodinkee.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'll admit I'm a fan of your work, but not the book that's sitting in front of us until recently. But having been to the restaurant and the wine bar before, pretty fantastic experiences there.
We'll have fun, you know.
Yeah. So we got connected not through wine, which is what you're known for, but through watches, actually. And your colleague, Mr. Eric Repair, is a well-known watch guy, but it turns out you're a bit of a watch guy, too.
Yeah, I'm a little bit hidden there and under the radar. I'm not too loud about it, but it's funny, you know, I dove into that world a little bit and realized, actually, we talk to the same audience here.
Yeah.
A collector is a collector, and they care for details, they care for little things, and you know, those little things, they make the difference, right? For someone who doesn't really look after it, you know, it's okay, might be not so special, but for the one who knows, wow, this is really cool.
Yeah. I mean, when did you first get interested in watches?
In 2001.
Okay. And what kind of precipitated this? What started things?
I spoke to a watch journalist.
that'll do it. We have a reputation.
I was drawn onto his watch because it was the IWC, the GST.
Oh, cool.
Perpetual calendar.
Yeah.
You know, in titanium, they don't produce it anymore. But I thought, wow, this is actually a really cool piece. And he actually raved about it too. He said, because you can wear it. You can wear it all the time.
Mm. And so from there, what was the kind of process from that moment until you said, okay, maybe I want to like buy a nice watch, an interesting watch?
You know, I love research. Hmm. I spend countless hours after work or sometimes in the morning researching what's the difference, looking into the finer details, reading reviews, reading what people have to say. And I find that is a really cool process, how I've always done things, whether it's with wine, but also with watches. So I find that part very interesting. But then I got as a gift once a Rolex, and then the damage was done.
that'll do it, yeah.
Well, they were very kind to me. And yeah, then The next one was a Jaeger LeCoultre.
Okay. And what drew you to that watch? Because the watch, can you tell us about the Jaeger LeCoultre you have? It's an interesting one.
Yeah, it's a master compressor.
Yeah.
Geographic. Well, I moved to the United States, so having two time zones, I thought it came incredibly handy.
Yeah.
It's a little sportier because I had the Rolex, the Datejust, and then I thought I'd go a little sportier. And it had a rubber band also. Mm. And for me, running around all day long, I wasn't really particularly fond of leather bands because you have to change them nonstop. And so a rubber band you can wash, and I thought, this is just perfect. Mm.
And then from there, you ended up kind of dipping your toes into Vacheron Constantin, which is what you have on today.
Yeah. Well, this is my almost my daily watch, believe it or not, because it's so discreet. Mm-hmm. No one calls me out on it. And I have this now for this watch, this Quai de Lille I have now for, I think, 8 years.
Okay.
8, 9 years.
Okay.
And I think 4 people called me out on it.
That's not too bad.
Which is great.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I like to be... there's a beautiful thing in modesty.
Yeah, agreed. Can you tell us about this particular model? Because it's one that you don't see... I haven't seen this watch too often.
No, it's kind of a little weird. The Quai de Lille series, I thought, was especially astonishing because you could assemble it yourself if you wanted. Also, this is rather unique because the titanium is super light. Mm-hmm. And it's also the dial is made by the same company who makes the Swiss franc. Mm. So it's quite cool. And I thought, this is actually rather unique. And I think Vacheron got away a little bit from Quai de Lille.
Yeah, it's a really cool watch because there's something nice. I mean, you said there's something beautiful in modesty. And it's cool to see a watch from a brand like that, that it's a super high-end, really amazing watch. I mean, there really isn't much better watchmaking out there than Vacheron, but to have it in titanium, it's all matte finished, it's on a rubber band. It's like, it's really under the radar, even amongst watch guys.
Yeah, totally. And it's super unique and they don't even produce it much anymore. So I like these kind of things, you know, as robust as a Rolex is, but they produce 1,000,000+ pieces. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and like in wine, you know, I look for artisanal wines. I look for craftsmanship. And obviously, with this watch, you have craftsmanship because there's not that much produced.
Yeah. I mean, there's two things I want to touch on here that kind of make this watch make me think of what you do in the wine world. One is this idea of modesty, and the other is this idea of craftsmanship. So we'll start with the first one. What you do is very service oriented, right? You're with customers, you're with guests a lot of the time. So having something that's a bit discreet, right, is probably an advantage for you, right? Like, you don't want anything that's going to be distracting for your clients or your guests, right?
Yeah, one of them focus on me, not on my wrist. For me, often it goes the other way around.
Yeah.
But it's very important. Look, in a time like where we're today, where we constantly live with distractions, mostly with the cell phone or social media or emails or text messages, where so many channels come into us and we communicate with it, you know, there's always sometimes something lost. And I can observe this sometimes, you know, when people have a lunch or dinner, they're more on their cell phones rather than talk to their opponent. Mm-hmm. And what's the point of spending time together?
Yeah. No, I totally agree.
I mean, I've called me old school, but connecting with the person and, you know, having the conversation is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I completely agree. And to touch on the other point, you talk about craftsmanship and that, you know, wine and watches seem like kind of a natural fit together. You know, they're both... There's something old school about them, but there's also innovation happening. There's an element of tradition and of history, but also new traditions and new history being written. They're very detail-oriented. You can go, you know, kind of as shallow or as deep as you want. Do you see relationships between those two things?
You know, it's interesting because I've done with Vacheron Constantin a wine watch tasting.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I like to push boundaries. I like to push myself also. And I've realized there's a ton of similarities with it. And you can connect the topic. I've done it also with art. Of course, it's a little bit esoteric. It's a little bit out there. But the success was so big on the first one that they continued this. So I have quite a relationship with them. I like the idea, what they put out there. So yes, there's a ton. So I was fortunate enough even to go to the factory. And so I could see all the parts and the components. And when you deassemble it, how detail-oriented it is. I mean, there's things just the way how they take the 45-degree angle when you turn it around. So no sharp edges. It's with wines basically the same thing. You know, you don't want to have sharp edges. You want to have a little bit softness in there. But you still look for complications. So there's a ton of similarities.
And so when you do a watch and wine tasting, right? Like what are you looking for when you're pairing watches and wines? What similarities?
It's often a storytelling. I mean, I give you a perfect example. You take like a watch, like a Geographic, or you take like an Overseas. You know, it's a traveling watch. So, and you connect this, for instance, which wines were famously known for traveling? And you come very quickly to Madeira, who traveled to the equator and going over with the West Indian Dutch Company. And travel with that. So there's a story right there. And then, of course, you see also it showcase immediately the complexity of it. Madeira is super complex, but it's also very grabbing. It's a very grabbing wine. And so that connection you put immediately.
Great. And do you find that when you have, you know, the customers and the guests at something like this, do people kind of pick up on those stories quickly, or do you feel that it requires a bit more kind of explanation?
You know, at first there's a little hesitation, obviously. It's not straightforward. I've done it with Vacher & Content, and I think 5 seminars on that. So I think that's a statement in itself.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah. If they want to keep having you back, it must be working.
I have done it in Europe also. And that was a more broader thing. That's when I realized that's a possibility. So totally possible. I've done it with R2, where I had a very critical client from Le Barada and inviting himself into because he couldn't envision that. And he's the type of character where, you know, when God gave out diplomacy, he was absent. So I was kind of scared at first.
Yeah.
But then actually he said, this is really cool.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that there are some similarities in terms of the people that we're speaking to, you know, who we speak to and who you speak to. And that's something I think is really fascinating about this, the whole sort of luxury world in general, right? Is the clients tend to be extremely knowledgeable. They tend to be extremely discerning, and they sort of have that ability to access anything. And so you have to find new ways to make things special. You have to push yourself to help push them because, you know, having a really great bottle of Chateau de Chem maybe like might be special to a lot of people, but I would imagine to a lot of your clients, like they could have that every evening if they want it. So you need to find something new and something to push them. How do you think about that, about trying to, you know, give people new experiences and challenge and push people a little bit?
You know, the beauty of my job, and especially in the current setup, we know where I work at Le Bernardin on a 3 Michelin star level, but then I have on the other side, the Aldersum wine bar, is I get the entire kind of, you know, I get from people who just look for its glass of Sauvignon Blanc, for exactly that person who looks for the Chateau Yquem. And I find this super fascinating because while you have someone who is really on the beginning of its, you know, wine interest, you go to someone who is very, very advanced. And you have every table is different. Every customer is different. You have the different needs to satisfy. And I find that fascinating because I care for the human aspect and I listen to them and I look where they are. And, you know, some people want to stay classic, what they know. And some people say, you know, I don't need you because if I look for this Chateau Yquem, because I just opened the Wine Spectator and can find out of myself. A lot of these people like to do their own research. But you actually give me wines which I've never heard of, and I research, then I see how special they are. For instance, if you drink Chateau Yquem and spend that kind of money, try a wine from Egon Müller, who is one of the absolute Riesling uber stars, especially in the sweet segment. So then we talk really about craftsmanship. Because if you go to his Trockenbrenner, let's say his highest level, He makes 100 liters a year.
Wow.
Yeah. So talking about craftsmanship and talking about minima.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, there's something interesting too, because when you mentioned already, right, that Rolex makes, let's say, 1 million watches a year, whereas this producer makes 100 liters a year. In addition to this,
on average.
Yeah. So in addition to the scale being different, you're also talking about something that lasts forever versus something that's consumed, right? And that's something that I think is fascinating, because we hear from people all the time that one of the things they like about watches, and one of the reasons why they feel comfortable investing in watches, is that, you know, I have it, I pass it down to my son or my daughter, they pass it down to their son or daughter, and it's essentially something that lasts forever. Whereas you might be able to sell her a great bottle of wine, but at some point you drink it and it's gone. Do you think that kind of ethereal nature is part of the pleasure for people, or do you think it's kind of a sticking point, or both?
Well, I raise a question based on your question.
Okay.
Does really everything last forever?
No, not at all. Exactly. No, nothing lasts forever.
Nothing lasts forever.
No.
And you know, at the end of the day, we leave everything behind. So
very true.
You know, but there is a very special point in just researching and finding the bottle you ultimately look for. So your journey starts right there. Just going to that store, buying that special bottle, then you sell it. Most people actually take incredible joy of just going often to the cellar and seeing that bottle over the years, which you collected. Some people actually never opened that bottle, and there's often also the joy in there.
Mm.
Yeah? Of course, it stops lasting forever the moment you pull out your wine key.
Right.
Because then, you know, the experience starts. But that is actually the journey of it. And that's the beauty of it, because you will save that memory, hopefully.
Yeah, no, I think that's, yeah, hopefully. Depends how many memories you're making in one night, but yeah.
I mean, also, look, we live in a very fast-moving world. Sometimes, you know, collectors, everyone is very generous. You bring a lot of friends in, and the speed becomes so high. So you really have to be focused, you know, to look at every single wine.
Mm.
Sometimes, you know, the biggest, the boldest wine is, of course, creates the most noise. But sometimes the one with the most delicacy is actually the best one.
Mm. You mentioned already that you kind of divide your time between your wine bar and Le Bernardin. And what do you see as the kind of ways that these two things complement one another for you?
You know, it's interesting. Eric Ribert was at first, and Maggie Lacoste, the owners of Le Bernardin, they were, of course, in the very beginning, a little concerned that the wine bar might take customers away from the Le Bernardin lounge, which was, we see as casual.
Mm.
What we've learned actually in the process is it's actually not at all, because while the wine bar, of course, is much more informal, much more casual, people still walk into Le Bernardin, even though we see it as casual. And it is, but it's not in people's minds. So it's interesting, the audience at the wine bar is maybe also a little bit younger.
Mm-hmm.
Even though at Le Bern, it's a complete mix. And actually, that's the beautiful thing.
Mm.
So, but they communicate with each other ironically,
mm.
even though they have nothing in common.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. have you seen Le Bernardin evolve over the years and change? Have you seen the audience change, the sort of feel, the atmosphere change?
I mean, time is change. Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing. We just hang on often on, you know, the things we grew up with and we want to hold on to. But time is change.
Mm.
And yes, we evolve all the time. And I think that's a good thing.
Mm.
I mean, I still remember we had to put wine orders in via telephone. No one does that today anymore.
Oh,
right?
Really?
Today we email it in and that's it.
Interesting.
It was super complicated. And you had to go through almost a telephone book through all the wines which were in the market. Right? It was a nightmare to order.
So, I assume it's much easier now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good thing, you know, we evolve.
I mentioned at the beginning that Eric Ribert is sort of a known watch guy in the watch world. Are there other folks in the kind of like New York restaurant scene or the sommelier scene who are watch guys who you know of? I mean, is a love of watches kind of a common thing in that community?
I mean, I haven't met anyone who doesn't like watches. yes. I mean, look at all the big chefs. They all love watches.
Mm. Do you have any idea why?
I mean, for a man, it's very challenging. I mean, we don't have jewelry, or very few, but this is basically the only piece we put on. Mm-hmm. To me, I look, there's a beauty in that. Mm-hmm. And at least for me, I can only speak for myself. And I like that. But that's as far as I go in terms of jewelry. I don't have anything else on. Mm.
Cool. Well, I want to make sure we have time to talk about your book, which I have sitting in front of me and which I've been really enjoying over the last couple days. It's called Wine Simple. It came out at the end of last year, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And it's, I can honestly say it is unlike any other book I've read about wine. It's super accessible. It's really easy to kind of like, you can pick up and flip through, you know, 5 to 10 pages when you have a few minutes and then put it down and pick it back up later. What was kind of the whole idea behind this book?
I mean, the book is out now since a little bit more than 2 months.
Okay.
And the idea of putting Wine Simple together is, it came at the wine bar, but also at Le Bernardin. Look, as you can hear, my accent does not come from Brooklyn, nor from New Jersey.
It doesn't? No?
Not quite. But I don't speak English in that part. So that's why it was very important. And Christine Mulke, who wrote the book with me, was obviously a crucial part to make this book, first of all, sound in English, and secondly, take all the Aldoisms out. Mm. There's plenty. But joking aside, no, look, I work on a daily basis on the floor, and I work with people. And I constantly see how people often are uncomfortable and intimidated about just ordering a glass of wine. And I'm on the other side of that spectrum, and I wanted to help these victims, mm-hmm. right? Because it doesn't have to be so difficult, and it should be fun. Of course, I mean, if you get someone onto a watch and start showing him right away a tourbillon, the disconnect might be right there, but that's not the idea. And Wine Simple is something where, you know, I take people, I take the topic wine, and I bring them on a little bit of a personal journey I went through. And trust me, wine is still intimidating for me, and I'm doing this now for 28 years. That's normal. But that's also the evolution we talked about before. But Wine Simple is also one thing where it grabs you and it gives you, goes on a little journey with you, and it breaks it out down in sound bites. Mm-hmm. That's actually Jancis Robinson from the Financial Times reviewed it last week. And she actually put this down. It's unlike a different book because I'm not a writer. Mm. I spend 20 minutes on the desk on average a day. I'm on the floor. And that's why I think different and I see the fears what people have. And that's what I put in. That's why it's different. That's why also in chapter 2, I wrote, we had the chapter in there saying, you know, why do we need another book?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's not sometimes from a professional writing for another professional. That's not the idea here. I wanted to talk to a lot of people.
Yeah, what do you think are maybe like two or three things that you think people find most intimidating about wine? Like when you're dealing with customers at lunch who want a glass, or you know, a couple of folks ordering a bottle at dinner, what are the things that people seem most kind of like anxious and concerned about?
Oh, price, obviously. Mm. That's for everyone intimidation, because if you're not comfortable with wine, and if you open a wine list like at Le Bernardin with 50 pages, Murphy's Law will drive you to the Roma de Conti page, which starts with a couple thousand dollars, right?
Yeah.
So that's Murphy's Law, but it doesn't have to be like that. So that's the one part. The other part is read a tasting note. Most people read tasting notes, whether they read in the New York Times or Wine Spectator or with all kinds of Venus Media. Sometimes these tasting notes, you know, when I talk, like, for instance, the wine smells like gooseberries, maybe have toasted almonds. That's very hard for people to grasp. Mm. So that's intimidating because I can't smell that. Most people can tell you how a strawberry smells. And again, there is also a surprising effect for me in that, because I come back to the conversation piece we had before. Look, we eat and put food often in ourselves while we're checking social media, which is, of course, a very important thing, don't get me wrong. However, you know, this is such an important part. So we feed ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we feed so we can have an output in terms of work. But we don't really pay attention what we put in ourselves. So it's funny because everyone knows how a strawberry smells. We just cannot locate it.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that. The idea that like being distracted, we don't think about these things anymore. Do you think that has changed? Do you think maybe 20, 30 years ago, it would have been easier maybe to get people to pick up on those things? Or do you think there would have just been other distractions?
That's a good possibility. I mean, look, we live right now. Everyone becomes a little bit more health conscious too. Mm-hmm. We're paying more attention. Look how many diets just out there.
Yeah.
Fascinating. That wasn't 30 years ago. So yes, we become more conscious, but I think that becomes, and food is also on a much different level where it was 30 years ago. Look at the cuisines we run right now and look how many talented chefs and restaurants are just here in New York City, mm-hmm. let alone the United States. So, but even there, the funny that people have difficulties describing the flavor of a strawberry is ironic.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But to me, when I eat, I smell pretty much on anything and mm-hmm. I pay attention to it. Also, when I go hiking, you smell. If you walk by rosemary, you can smell. If you walk by fresh cut grass, you can smell that. It's just for our brain to associate that with. Mm.
What do you find has changed most about people's wine tastes over the last couple of years?
I think Americans discovered the greatness in a lifestyle with wine. Mm. It becomes a cultural component. It becomes a lifestyle component. And they caught up on that big time. Which is great to see because people were never as thirsty about wine as today they are. Mm-hmm. And some of them start slowly collecting, some of them start rapidly. It's really impressive to see. And it's very easy today to get to knowledge. Mm-hmm. You do it on your smartphone.
Yeah.
Super simple. You follow people on Instagram. Again, it can be very, very quick. Today, you just have to pay maybe more attention on to filter the information. Back in the day, you know, when I started reading about wine, you had to buy books.
Right. Yeah. Which is funny because now you have a book.
Yeah.
One of the things I really like about Wine Simple isn't just the information itself, but it's the way it's presented. The illustrations, the way things are broken out into charts and maps. I wonder how you thought about not just making sure that people who read the book would get the information they needed, but would also get some context and also maybe have fun reading it. Like the book feels fun. It feels lighthearted, which I think is a big part of maybe making this more accessible.
The book is me, in a sense. It's an expression. Look, when you try to get onto something and have to learn or study something, the moment you have fun with the topic, whatever that is, you start diving in. It becomes easy. It's like with cleaning. If something is difficult to clean, you don't want to clean. If something is easy to clean, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
It's studying the same thing. And that actually was the idea. So, you know, to make this exciting, to make this fun, to give these little sound bites, you can have it as a coffee table book mm-hmm. within 10 seconds. You can take something from it, but if you want to spend more time, by all means. That's the idea. And keep this entertaining. I give personal stories. I give also opinions. So, because often people are scared to form their own opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, people always say, I don't know much about wine, but I do know what I like. And I said, that's actually significant. Mm. Yeah. So that's quite a milestone.
What do you think the obstacles are to people forming their own opinions and own taste? Because something we talk about here all the time is that Instagram and sort of the new generation of you know, kind of the way people talk about watches and share watches creates a uniformity of taste. Everybody thinks there are, you know, these 10 watches that everyone's supposed to like and everything else is kind of boring or they should let it go. Do you find the same thing happens in wine where there's certain things people think they're supposed to love and certain things people think they're supposed to not love? Or is it kind of a different dynamic?
No, there's a certain mainstream with no question. I mean, most consumers like Sauvignon Blanc. Mm. And, you know, because it's straightforward, there's a lot of taste. For someone who starts collecting, he probably gets away from that. Mm-hmm. They can be also sometimes a little industrial in production. But again, what is right and what is wrong? I'm not here to determine that. Look, you're at a certain stage in your life. If you want to continue that, that's by all means, it's all good. If you want to evolve, you know, you will discover very quickly, you know, there's a much bigger world out there to dive in. And again, it's very easy to do today. You just see, okay, if you like watch X, in with most internet research you do today, you can have this algorithm.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Right.
So it gives immediately, you know, if you like this watch, you might like that. Mm-hmm. And if you like this, and this is endless, where it drives you. Eventually, you get into it. You just have to spend time onto it. Mm. And that's with wine exactly the same. I push sometimes, you know, the people I know for a little while, I push their palates. Mm-hmm. You cannot drink every day, you know, Romane Conti. I mean, as great as it is, but your palate might get bored, even though it's one of the greatest wines. So why don't you try this and why don't you try that? And like that also, you create a library and you create a collection of data in your mind. But also a collection of experiences, which is incredibly important.
This week's episode is brought to you by the Hodinkee Shop. The Hodinkee Shop was created by watch lovers for watch lovers. It started way back in 2012 with a handful of watch straps and travel pouches, and it's grown to include dozens of strap options, tons of travel accessories, the best watch books and magazines, outstanding vintage watches, and some of the most desirable modern watches on the market today. It's truly a full-service destination for anyone interested in watches. In addition to stocking the products you want, the Hodinkee Shop is committed to making the discovery and buying process itself as fun and convenient as it can be. You can browse and shop anywhere in the world directly on your computer, tablet, or smartphone, and the incredible photographs ensure you get a vivid, accurate look at whatever you're considering. It doesn't stop there, though. Once you've ordered a watch, you can count on complimentary, expedited shipping to get it to you as quickly as overnight. An extra year of warranty is included at no additional charge, and all of your paperwork is stored digitally, so you don't have to sweat losing those precious papers. Importantly, when it comes to modern watches, the Hodinkee Shop is an official authorized retailer for all brands it carries. This means you're guaranteed to be getting a brand new, fully authentic watch with its full warranty. There's no funny business at all. The experience is truly best in class from top to bottom, and it's what the Hodinkee Shop thinks 21st century luxury is all about. To learn more and to take a look at the full range of watches, accessories, and more, visit shop.hodinkee.com. All right, let's get back to the show. I wonder if I can ask you to give listeners a few suggestions here. So, you know, maybe can you pick maybe three or four styles of wine that are things you see as common, things people order and drink all the time, and then maybe offer a kind of alternative take, something else people should try?
I could do that, but then you don't buy the book because
that's fair. That's very, very fair.
I actually have a page allocated to that.
Oh, perfect.
And that's the idea. Look, if you like Pinot Noir, try this variety. And if you like this variety, try that variety. So we hand that in. And that makes this book so unique. And actually, Jens has pointed that out, that this makes it so accessible. Mm. Because sometimes, you know, look, if I don't want to spend the money on Burgundy, I don't necessarily have to go there. So you can, you know, spend that money into Santa Barbara County Pinot Noir Chardonnay, which offers a great amount of value right now, right? But, you know, you have to get away from the label thinking and really start looking, what do I like?
Yeah. Have you found, I mean, you mentioned that there's been a cultural change in the U.S. and incorporating wine into culture, but have you noticed that palates are changing, or you mentioned, you know, diets, things like natural wines? Are these sort of things that you think will be long-term shifts in the market, or do you think these are sort of fads, things that will come and go and there will be new things kind of year after year?
No, I think, I mean, look... Natural wine is a very divisive topic, and it becomes almost tribal, that thinking, you know, the natural wines versus the conventional wines. I've personally seen this now for a couple of years, and I've seen this very strong coming. And I said this recently in an interview where we had a panel discussion. I said, look, this is wine. If you bring 10 random people to a bar, give them a glass of wine, and give them 10 minutes, and they start talking with each other. Mm-hmm. This tribal thinking has to stop. We have to build a bridge. Mm-hmm. Because, look, if one loves oysters, the other one doesn't. Who is right and who is wrong? Mm-hmm. It's just where you currently are. What you enjoy, you know, what you enjoy is subjective. Mm-hmm. It's the same with watches. One says, listen, this Rolex is the greatest watch because it works for me just perfectly. You know, I can have it on a suit. I just can have it with a pair of jeans. It's all good. Mm-hmm. The other one says, I would never wear that because for me, Patek or Vacheron, this is much more exclusive. Da, 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 da. Again, this is endless.
Yeah.
You have to accept that and you have to be comfortable with it. And we evolve with it, and that's good.
Yeah, I think
that's trends great. Come and go. I don't think, to answer your question completely, is as we become more health conscious, we get maybe on the topic natural wine a little bit more, but natural wine can be really extreme in terms of flavors. It's often a little bit ill-informed because people think they're allergic to sulfites, and sulfites is a bad thing. Even though just if you order a side of French fries, there's much more sulfites in than an average bottle of wine. Mm-hmm. So every fermentation by default produces sulfite as a byproduct. So I think, look, the truth is somewhere in the middle. It's not in one extreme or the other. It's somewhere in the middle. And I think with these conventional wines, it pushes them also to work with less additives and less chemicals. And with with natural wine, I think there's also a middle way. And that's good. Mm.
Do you find, you work with customers all day, and I wonder, have you started to get to a point where, you know, when someone walks in, you can look at the watch on the wrist or how they're dressed or kind of how they carry themselves and say, like, before even saying a word to anybody, like, I think this person should order this.
This would lead to a very beginner's kind of thing because, you know, in today's world, I think experience is one of the most, combined with knowledge, is the most important thing you have. Just having the knowledge is one thing, theoretical, but putting this out with experience, you learn immediately. It would do cardinal sin in New York. You never know who's in front of you, and you certainly do not know where these people are in 2 years. So I don't have the liberty to judge. Do I look at certain components? 100%. Right. I had, for instance, a client in front of me a couple of years ago. Now we became actually quite good friends, who said to me, you know, I'm not like here, like everybody here at Le Bernardin in our dining room. I'm just a regular guy from a suburban area. Right. So I barely can afford a meal here. And I said, but so can you recommend me a wine for regular civilians? And he was rather provocative with that. And I said, sir, I love the area where you're from because I live also in the suburbs in Brooklyn. And I said, but in Brooklyn, not many people wear FP Journée. So, you know, but I said this with a smile, you know, and he started laughing out so loud.
That's a good one.
Right. So you know, with a smile, you can do so many things. And with a little sense of humor, you can do so many things, right? We don't have to be so stiff about it. And yes, of course, I read this poem, but this is how I utilize it.
So you're always, I would imagine you always have to be kind of keyed into those little details, not just the details about the wines you're serving, but the details about the people serving.
For me, it's mainly the person who's in front of me.
Yeah.
I am listening because look, someone comes with a perfectly tailored suit. Someone comes with and so on and so on. You can add this on. They just maybe want to have a whiskey or the person drinks a beer. You completely misjudged.
Yeah.
Right? I think the 10 seconds I talked to him are much more important. What is he looking for? Where is he with his current knowledge base? And also, what does he want to drink? Mm-hmm. Of course, I look at all the other components. There's no question about it. But again, that's where the experience comes in.
Yeah.
For me, the person who is in front of you is the important part. As a sommelier, you have to listen and cater. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. Sometimes the wine knowledge is actually secondary.
Mm. Yeah, you said that you can do a lot with a smile. And I think that's an important thing here. It's something we try to do with watches all the time. And it seems like something you try to do with wine is making these things fun. Like at the end of the day, it's just wine. It's just watches. Like if you're not enjoying it and it doesn't bring joy to your life, then it sort of, in our perspective at least, kind of loses a lot of its value. And I wonder how you encourage people to both kind of learn and enjoy the scholarship, but also just like enjoy the experience of having a nice glass of wine in front of you.
I mean, I'm very fortunate. Look, I had my success in my career and still have it. And it's a beautiful thing. With that, of course, comes a little, you become a little more relaxed rather than tense, that you have to still hunt it. The quite key question in life is, look, what is life really important about? That you're happy. Money can buy you this to a degree, but 100% happiness comes from much more. So you have only one life. It's anyway that short. So you want to enjoy yourself. And it's all meant to be anyway. So look, Murphy's Law applies to you. The more energy I give to something bad happening this morning, the more will get it. So I shoved this aside and, you know, tried to approach this from a funny thing. And I learned this from Eric, actually. Something happens and he starts laughing about it and kind of dissolves the situation in his own way. But coming onto wine, it's the same thing. Look, we three have a glass of wine right now. We start laughing at one point because it's, you know, life is fun and you should keep it fun. And with watches, the same thing. It's you want to hang out with people who stimulate you, and you learn something from them.
So should we crack a bottle?
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's what, it's almost 11 o'clock in the morning. We could get going.
You know, there is the big difference. People always say, you know, because I start tasting wine typically at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the morning, and of course people say, "You drink at 10 o'clock in the morning." And I said, "No, no, no." There's a huge difference between tasting and drinking. When we taste, we spit. Mm-hmm. Because the moment you start absorbing alcohol, you cannot judge critically anymore, right? And I have to pull that switch in my brain to taste analytical. Because what I like is one thing, but you know, I have to cater to a broad audience. And I had this once in a seminar I gave, I had this lovely woman telling me, "You have the best job in the world." And I said to her, "While I agree with you, what do you mean with that?" She said, you can buy all the wines you like. And I said, said, my answer will shock you right now, because do you know how many wines I buy I personally dislike? Because if, for instance, I give you a perfect example, I do not like creamy buttery Chardonnay. That's not my cup of tea. But I buy them. I just taste and see, taste analytical to see whether they're technically correct made. And they fit. Because what I'm going to tell that person who likes that, it's not good. I'm not a dictator. Dictatorships typically didn't work out so well.
True.
Right? And no, but it's the same thing. Or you have someone who drinks a specific broader marketed champagne. Simple as that. You want to tell them you have to go to a grower champagne because this is rubbish? No, it's not. Let him drink. Make him comfortable to you. Make him trust you, and then you turn them. It's a very simple, it's a progress, and we have to accept that. Look, I started also, you know, I started with a Swatch. Now look, the Swatch was the most precise watch I've ever owned.
My Swatch is definitely the most precise watch I own. Yeah.
You hate it or love it, but this is just a reality. No mechanical watch is precise. But why do people buy a not precise watch? I mean, there's the contradiction in its own.
Yeah, it's because it's fun. Yeah, it's fun. It's beautiful. It's enjoyable for other reasons.
Every Apple Watch is more accurate.
Yeah,
I see this actually in watch journalists too now. Apple Watches, and I can't.
Yeah.
I can't pull it up.
There's many people in this office who own and wear them.
Yeah. So to me, I don't own them because it would drive me crazy getting text messages on my wrist.
I'm sure. Yeah.
So, I like the beauty of the craftsmanship, you know, and I like the beauty of the history, and I like the beauty of that story which comes with it. And again, as a man, we are only a specific amount of jewelry.
Yeah. Well, I wanna wrap up. We're gonna bring back something we call the Hodinkee questionnaire, the Hodinkee Radio questionnaire. So it's a couple of sort of quick fire questions. You can just give me the first answer off the top of your head. So the first question is, what's a watch that's caught your eye recently?
Oh, I have constantly one. There's always one. I love the Lange & Söhne, the Saxonia, which came out.
Yeah.
Probably my ultimate timepiece would be the Datograph.
Yeah.
Oof. Because I'm not sure what's more beautiful, the back or the front.
Completely agree. Yeah. Perfect. What's the best place you've traveled in the last year?
Portugal.
Portugal.
Yeah. I lived in Europe. I grew up there. Never dawned on me to go to Portugal. It was amazing.
Great.
Yeah.
Anywhere specific in Portugal?
Lisbon, and then we went down to Comporta.
Okay.
Which
Great.
Is kind of the Hamptons of Portugal.
Sounds good to me. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given, and who gave it to you?
Who? You know, I work. The greatness in New York is you encounter the smartest and the best people from all of their fields. So I have a very open mind to that. And whether they're from your industry or not at all, I encounter on a daily basis the smartest and the best people within their fields. So I listen to that daily. And I couldn't give you one because I collect them literally.
Mm. Perfect. What's your guilty pleasure?
Oh, chocolate.
Yeah?
Terrible.
What's your chocolate of choice?
You know, I'm not as particular there. I like milk chocolate, but lately I go to Maison de Chocolat and get to the truffles.
Okay.
And yeah, there's no stopping, sadly.
Perfect. And we'll do a special question for you for the last one. It's your last meal. What are you eating and what are you drinking with it?
Oi, oi, oi. Hopefully this is far away. My last meal. I probably will take a champagne.
Yeah.
From a smaller grower. Probably a Charton Taillé, which is he's a true artisanal champagne producer. Probably will pick his Le Bar vineyard with the grape Pinot Noir. And the greatness on champagne is it's one of the most food-friendly wines you can pair it with. You can open this in the late morning. You can open this late night. Champagne will always work. And yeah.
And what are you eating with that champagne?
What do I eat with that? Probably a specific langoustine dish Eric Repair made with mashed salad, white balsamic vinaigrette, and a little foie gras. I know it's guilty, but...
It's all right. It's your last meal. You're allowed.
It was one of these magical dishes.
Perfect. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here. And we're going to link up Wine Simple so people can go order copies for themselves. Comes highly, highly recommended. And hope to see you at the wine bar at La Bernardin soon.
Oh, yeah. Please let me know when you come.
Awesome. Will do.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, we have Jack's conversation with Grand Seiko designer Nobuhiro Kosugi.
So, Mr. Kosugi, welcome. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Hodinkee Radio. We've all traveled a very, very long way to get here, and you folks have come here in the face of some really terrible weather. So thank you again. And I think I'd like to start by asking you to just sort of introduce yourselves to our listeners. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be at Seiko and Grand Seiko.
私が時計業界に足を踏み入れたのが
I joined the watch industry in it was 1973 and it wasn't in Seiko it was a different maker but specifically I was a case designer after leaving that company for 10 years I was a freelance designer and had worked with Seiko during the 10 years of freelance and after 10 years in about 1993 I joined Seiko Instruments as a designer and worked closely with sports designs as well as with watches that required high functionality and practicality of daily use. It wasn't until 1995 though when I started to be in charge of the Grand Seiko design. Although we might talk about this later, in terms of the 44GS, I had experience or knew about the 44GS before joining Seiko at the previous company where I was a case designer. And the reason why I heard of 44GS was because I was told at the previous company that the 44GS was a case design that we should not follow and we should not learn from. And the reason was because the case design was too multidimensional. The balance between the surfaces were at the standard of the time not good, and it was too difficult for anyone to manufacture and produce. And the thinking behind that was that an industrial product or watch should not be made to be so difficult to manufacture. So I was told when I joined the watch industry that that was a design that we should not be following. And in 2014, when the reinterpretation model of the 44GS came out, I was in charge of its design. And I had asked my team, are you sure? Do you really want to design it based on the 44GS? And by 2014, of course, the skill of manufacturing of the factories was more developed than back in the 70s when I was told that it was not a great design, because the skill had improved and the watchmaker's ability and skill had also improved dramatically, it was possible to reinterpret the 44GS and produce a new watch in 2014. And by skill, I'd like to mention especially the skill of polishing by the craftsman really developed over the years.
I was going to ask this a little bit later, but now seems a natural time to do it since we're already discussing 44GS. I'm very curious, you mentioned differences between the reintroduction and the original model. Can you tell us how the design has evolved over the years? What are the similarities and differences between the original 44GS case and the new one?
Well, for example, if I can mention a few points, in terms of the glass, we used sapphire for the reintroduction version, whereas in the previous, it was more a box-shaped plastic glass. So that was one change. And another, the level of water resistance, for example, changed, and the quality in that sense has improved dramatically. So one similarity I'd like to mention is found in the polishing of the case for the original 44GS and the reintroduction of the 44GS. And by that, the way to polish the case, only the skilled craftsmen who have that technique can polish it in a way that is required for the reintroduction. Therefore, it was not possible to ask new craftsmen to polish the cases. We had to have the experienced craftsmen and watchmakers to be involved in the creation process. Even at the level of tools, for example, the tool used to attach the case when polishing, these were the same tools that were used when the 44GS was first released. Therefore, the craftsmen had to be able to use these tools well in order to produce the reintroduction. And when thinking about how some parts of the design has changed or evolved, we wanted to give it a more modern look. And one thing we did was the size of the case, we made a bit thicker. We thought that would give a more modern appeal to the watch. Although very subtle, but this was one point that we carefully considered.
The 44GS has obviously been a very influential and very important model in recent years for Grand Seiko. I'm curious to know what some of his favorite models are of the new generation of Grand Seiko watches, both the 44GS cases and not. Which ones does he think are especially successful?
44GS の現代版がやはり私としては
I must say that the modern reinterpretation of the 44GS is a definite one of the favorite of mine. And the reason why is because what that design and the watch stands for. The 44GS, when introduced in 1967, established the Grand Seiko style. And for that, it remains very important. And by reintroducing it in a modern style is a way for us to value this particular style that was established in 1967. So that is why, to me, it is one of my favorite.
大切なデザインだと思っています。
One of the things that is very, very noticeable about all Grand Seiko watches, both the 44GS and others, is that how light is part of the composition. Something I'm very curious about is when you are designing a watch, what role does light play for you specifically in thinking about the design and how reflections, how light and dark surfaces work together, how they interact with each other?
So in terms of applying the idea of light and shadow in our Grand Seiko design, it is definitely an important part of what we call a grammar of our design. Light and shadow perhaps could be a concept that might be uniquely Japanese, or to say the Japanese have an appreciation towards the idea of light and shadow. Both are appreciated equally. For example, if you look at traditional Japanese furniture, you will see the use and the play of light and shadow. And even in shadow, we can see or interpret a gradation of colors or gradation of the shadow and giving it a dimensional look. So why do we incorporate this idea into the watch design? To capture the subtle reflections of the light and shadow, and to see that in the hour markers or the hands of the watch actually increases the legibility, which is very important for Grand Seiko. Therefore, this Japanese sense or appreciation of light and shadow actually directly links to the legibility of the Grand Seiko watch, which is very important. And this is why we incorporate this idea of light and shadow in our design.
So if I understand Mr. Kasugi, if I understand your answer correctly, light and shadow as design elements, they don't exist in isolation. It's important that they serve functionality as well. And this is very much a part of the ethos of Grand Seiko.
Grand Seiko の考え方としては、まずもちろん、
I believe your understanding is absolutely correct. And for Grand Seiko, of course, precision is one extremely important factor. And another, as we have been talking about, is legibility. For example, we also value the beauty found in the finish of the Grand Seiko to achieve a distortion-free finish throughout the watch. All of these lead directly to legibility, so the wearer can really feel that they can see the time. This is why it is very important for Grand Seiko.
This was not a question that I had originally intended to ask, but it just occurred to me, and I was wondering, Mr. Kasugi, if we could talk about it just a little bit. There are three technical pillars for Grand Seiko. There's a spring drive, there's Grand Seiko Mechanical, and there's a 9F Quartz. And one thing I'm quite curious about is, when you're designing a watch, how much does that aspect play into the design? Do you think differently when you're designing a mechanical watch versus spring drive versus 9F quartz? And if so, what are the differences for you?
その3つのエンジンでデザインを基本的に
So about your question, to be honest, I have never really considered a difference in design based on the three different types of movements that we have. When the 44 GS came out, it was a mechanical watch, historically, a mechanical movement. But now, this design style and philosophy is, as you know, applied to spring drive and quartz also. So, yes, in response, is there a difference in design for the three movements? Is not really. It's not a part of the consideration.
メインで考えたことはないですね。
We were talking earlier about finishing and about the process of finishing the case, the polishing process, and one term that we hear a lot is zaratsu polishing. And I'd like to hear from you, Mr. Kasugi. What is zaratsu polishing exactly? What makes polishing zaratsu polishing?
Zaratsu kenma っていうのは、まあ、スイスがもともと。
So about zaratsu polishing. I believe that it was from a Swiss company, the Salatz company, which introduced this machinery and this polishing. And then it was introduced in Japan in the 1950s, using this machinery and technique and sort of fine-tuning it to a more a way to fit the Japanese craftsman. We have been applying this the machinery and the technique of polishing to create this beautiful and distortion-free finishing that we are proud of for the Grand Seiko.
I just heard him use the word, I don't speak Japanese, as you know, Mr. Kasugi, but I heard you use the word shokunin. Can you explain what that means in the context of creating Grand Seiko watches and the craftsmanship that goes into them?
So in terms of shokunin, in my previous reply for a different question, I mentioned that the level of manufacturing in the factories of watch production increased over the years, which allowed the modern reinterpretation of 44GS to be possible. What happened over the years as the manufacturing level went up was that the level of the shokunin, or the craftsman, went down. And the only shokunin or craftsman that remained were limited. And out of the remaining craftsmen, I believe that the craftsmen who were in charge of polishing were the highest level in skill. And in terms of polishing, there have been many considerations to allow machinery to be more involved to make up for the fewer craftsmen there are. But I believe that the fact that the case has been polished by the hands of people, or the hands of the craftsmen, is much more valuable than a watch that has been finished or polished by machine. And I feel very strongly about this. And I think that this hand-finished value is very important in Grand Seiko.
推進していくとき、必ず私は職人さんに会いに行くんですよね。で、いくつか絵を。
So whenever we plan a new product or a new watch for Grand Seiko, I make sure that I meet the shokunin and the craftsman directly. And what I do is I bring along my sketches and illustrations of the new design and hear from them, you know, what do you think would be easy to make? What's difficult? Do you want to do this? Do you not want to do this? And there are many designs where the shokunin would say, this looks too difficult. It's too challenging. This would be the design that I do not want to make. I try very hard that the shokunin say exactly that. Basically, I want them to think that it is too difficult and out of their comfort zone. And why I do this is because as a designer, I also want to raise the level of the shokunin and the craftsmen. But I also know that a real shokunin is always up for the challenge. So this is why I make it to design something that is one step challenging and something that they can challenge themselves.
Last question. We were speaking just now of challenges and of challenging the shokunin, of challenging the craftsman. To you as a designer, what is the biggest challenge you've ever faced as a watch designer, and what are some of the challenges that you look forward to facing in the future?
To begin, I'd like to say that the skill necessary for the designer is becoming increasingly difficult over the last few years. And what is expected of a designer is the bar has been raised. And what I mean by that is most of the designs these days are made by computer graphics, are generated by computer graphics, which I find tremendously difficult to do. And there are many young designers who join the company who have a lot of skill with this in computer graphics. Working with them alone gives me great stimulation. What I try to do is I try to teach the young designers the sensitivity of design. And from the young designers, I learn about computer graphics. I think combining the two of the young designers' new skills and my experience with designing, we can create a brand new watch design.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show, Mr. Kasugi. It was really, really great to be able to talk to you and to hear directly from the person responsible for so many of the beautiful designs that I've experienced from Brand Seiko over the years. So thank you very much.
This week's episode was recorded at Hodinkee HQ in New York City and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.